This is the noise of a radiotherapy machine. We're in Cambridge, UK, and this machine is being used to help a woman be cured of breast cancer. Around half of patients with cancer will require radiotherapy to help either cure their cancer, prolong life, or ease suffering from their disease. But sadly, millions of cancer sufferers worldwide who had derived these benefits from radiotherapy will never hear that noise. This is because there is a massive shortage in global access to life-saving radiotherapy. 90% of individuals in low and middle-income countries do not have access to radiotherapy, and there are approximately 30 countries without any radiotherapy machines at all. I'm Saif Ahmed, and this is Global Access to Radiotherapy, The Silent Crisis. In this two-part podcast, we will speak to a range of experts and cancer doctors from across the globe who are aiming to improve the lives of millions of people worldwide by increasing access to radiotherapy in low and middle income countries. This includes an inspiring interview with a radiotherapy doctor from Cambodia who is part of an initiative to develop a national cancer centre in that country. We also hear from the authors of research articles from the latest Royal College of Radiologists Clinical Oncology Special Issue, which focuses on global access to radiotherapy. These articles look at the challenges and opportunities there are to address this grave inequality in healthcare, and interviewees include two doctors who are closely involved with an international movement centred on this issue, Global RT. We'll also be hearing from the President of the European Society of Therapeutic Radiation Oncology, ESTRO, Professor Yolanda Levens. In part one, we'll examine the scale of the problem, and we'll discuss research that helps quantify the radiotherapy access shortage and measure its consequences. In part two, we examine potential solutions to this crisis. Let's hear first from Dr. Moramel, a Cambodian radiation oncologist, who starts by telling us about the recent state of cancer radiotherapy in his country.
We used to have the radiotherapy facility back before the genocide regime, that means in the 1960s. But because of the civil war from 1970 up to 1979, everything was destroyed.
The genocide, Mora mentions, was instigated by the Khmer Rouge, led by Pol Pot. It led to the loss of up to 3 million lives.
And that's why it took us until 2000, when my supervisor, Professor Sokar, brought the Cobalt-60 machine donated by a French hospital back to Cambodia.
A Cobalt-60 machine is a relatively old-fashioned type of radiotherapy machine, but it can still be used effectively for treatment.
So the radiotherapy facility was introduced back then until 2013 or 14, when it broke down and then was decommissioned.
So what do the people of Cambodia who need radiotherapy do?
For those who can afford to pay, most of them will just go to Thailand or Vietnam in order to get the treatment. They stay there, or sometimes if they're really close to the border, they might make a trip every day to get a treatment. But I believe most of them stay there for the treatment. And for those who are really rich, it represents only like a small portion of the population, might go to Singapore or any other country which are more expensive.
In recent years, some very limited access to radiotherapy has become available in Cambodia. However, a large proportion of poorer patients are still going without any radiotherapy. In fact, Moore mentions that significant numbers of cancer patients still visit local healers for treatment. We'll revisit the situation in Cambodia later on in this podcast. Let's zoom out for now and examine the issue on a global level. Dr. Mei-Ling Yap and Dr. Danielle Rodin, who have authored articles within this clinical oncology special issue, along with their latest research, I want to know more about their work as members of the Global Task Force for Radiotherapy in Cancer Control, GTFRCC, and more specifically about the Global RT Initiative, a movement to turn radiotherapy into a global health priority. Mei-Ling is currently practicing in Sydney, Australia, and Danielle has been working in Toronto, Canada, though will soon be moving to the US to work at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. You'll have heard me use the term low and middle income countries earlier in this podcast. Mei-Ling begins by explaining what exactly this term means.
For the broader population, most people would have thought of low and middle income countries as other terms such as developing countries or the third world, but we don't tend to use those terms so much when we're speaking in terms of health and in policy and in cancer. And the reason for that is that there's quite a lot of variation in terms of countries that are considered low and middle income countries or developing countries, I suppose. So we've then broken it up into groups. There is quite a difference between, say, a low income country and a middle income country.
She explains further that these countries are divided by their gross national income, or GNI per capita. A low income country has a GNI per capita of less than $1,025. High income countries have a GNI per capita of more than $12,500. And in between are middle income countries, which themselves are divided into low middle income and high middle income.
For example, a low income country would be countries such as Cambodia is one in Asia. Also, quite a few of the African countries are low-income countries, such as Rwanda, Malawi. And middle-income countries, so low-middle-income countries, would include Laos, Vietnam, and upper-middle-income countries include countries such as China. So you can see there's quite a spread.
Mei Ling and Danielle now go on to tell us why looking at radiotherapy in low-middle-income countries is an important issue.
Everybody knows about AIDS and malaria and tuberculosis in these countries, but actually cancer accounts for more deaths across the world than HIV, tuberculosis and malaria combined. So it's certainly been an issue that hasn't had a lot of attention to date, and particularly in radiotherapy, because out of all the cancer treatments, I guess it has been the one that's probably been considered a bit less sexy than other topics. So a lot of people have been focusing on chemotherapy and drugs, but actually radiotherapy, I'd argue, is much more cost effective and effective in almost all cancer types. And so this issue has been previously deemed by our IAEA colleagues as the silent crisis, really because it's been a huge crisis, but one that not a lot of attention has been paid on.
The IAEA are the International Atomic Energy Agency. Danielle echoes these concerns.
In the article, I made the comment that radiotherapy is one of the biggest technology gaps in medicine today. And I think it's an important gap that has not been fully realized or recognized until very recently. You know, around the world, 40 to 60% of patients with cancer do not have access to radiotherapy services, despite the fact that it's a core component of optimal cancer care. And in fact, there's still several countries in the world where there are literally no radiotherapy machines. And the prevalence of cancer is rising. We had 14.1 million new cases of cancer in 2012, and that number is projected to be 24.6 million by 2030. And the greatest increases are actually expected to be in low and middle income countries where radiotherapy is least available. And that means that there are millions of people with cancer each year around the world who have no possibility of access to a life-saving treatment. And the Global Task Force on Radiotherapy for Cancer Control that was published last year projected that with a global commitment to increasing radiotherapy capacity to achieve universal access by 2035, we could save 26.9 million life years over the ramp-up period in low- and middle-income countries. And we could save almost a million people in 2035 alone. So there's a huge human imperative to raise awareness around this issue.
Mei Ling tells us the exact size of this technology gap.
About 5,500 machines in low- and middle-income countries at present that we would need to provide in order to bridge the gap in radiotherapy access. That would equate to being able to treat about 1.5 million patients.
When people first hear about this, they'd probably think that this would cost a lot of money, and is it not more efficient to spend that money on maybe cancer prevention or vaccinations or other things like that? So why should we be channeling our money into radiotherapy?
Of course, the primary aim of radiotherapy investment should be to improve the health and functioning of patients rather than just to save money. But a business case often helps program funders and policymakers to justify spending particularly in the setting of scarce resources. And that's what the Global Task Force on Radiotherapy for Cancer Control provided. It showed that there are huge national economic consequences from not providing adequate treatment for cancer. And in that consequence, really in the tens to hundreds of billions of dollars through lost labor productivity in low and middle income countries. And as the cancer burden continues to grow, this situation becomes even more dire. And it's sometimes difficult for policymakers to understand how such a large upfront investment in health technology can be cost saving. But the Global Task Force on Radiotherapy showed how a long-term commitment to health improvements in cancer care can facilitate important capital investments and can be economically efficient.
So you mentioned the Global Task Force. Can you tell us a little bit more about who the members are of this?
The Global Task Force on Radiotherapy for Cancer Control was an initiative that was launched under the President's portfolio of the Union for International Cancer Control, which is a global initiative based in Geneva that works to promote equity and awareness in global cancer control. And Dr. Mary Gospodarich, who is now the past president and was the president of the UICC in 2013 when the task force was launched, went alongside the task force chair, Dr. David Jaffrey. The UICC recruited more than 100 participants from radiotherapy, from oncology, from industry, from economics, and from public health to develop a so-called investment framework to achieve global equity and access to radiotherapy by 2035. And so it was really made up of people with a diverse skill set and from people all around the world who were able to share different perspectives in how this may be possible.
We will hear more from Danielle in part two, when she'll be talking in greater detail about how the economic arguments for improving radiotherapy access can be made. She'll also tell us about how the GTFRCC's work is being taken forward through the Global RT initiative. Mei Ling now tells us what cost benefits were identified in the 2015 GTFRCC report.
It depends on, there's a few different scenarios. So there's a scenario, for example, where you build up radiotherapy, but you don't really get more efficient in that. You sort of just build them to a kind of steady level. But then there's another scenario where as you start to expand services, you get more clever at doing it and you can do it a little bit more efficiently. And also you bulk purchase and vendors might kind of give you a better price and so on. And so then they've modelled a few different scenarios. For example, using one of the models, over a 20-year period, we estimated that in low-income countries, there would end up being a net economic benefit over 20 years of $265 million. And then all the way up to upper-middle-income countries, such as China, but this talking about all the upper-middle-income countries combined, their net economic benefit over about 20-year period would be $239 billion.
There are two important factors that contribute to the massive health and net economic benefits of improving radiotherapy access in low and middle income countries. The first relates to the age distribution of cancer in these regions.
The age distribution in terms of cancer is actually quite different in low and middle income countries compared to in high income countries. For example, in Australia, New Zealand, less than half of patients who are diagnosed with cancer are less than 65 years. In fact, so it's about 43%. But in Africa, 73% of patients diagnosed with cancer are less than 65 years of age. So the majority of cancer patients in Africa are actually of working age. So potentially, if we're able to cure cancers, then we're able to keep more people in the workforce.
The second relates to the types of cancers commonly seen in these countries.
In particular, the cancers that may be different to what we see in high-income countries like the UK or Australia is cervix cancer. The incidence is very high, particularly in low-income countries. Part of this is to do with not having cervix cancer screening that we have in our countries. And also head and neck cancers are very high in countries such as India, where the betel leaf and nut chewing is common practice. leading to, in particular, high incidence of oral cancers. And so these two cancers are cancers where radiotherapy plays a very important role in curing cancers as well as preventing cancers from coming back, and also in treating patients who can't be cured in order to help with very troubling symptoms such as bleeding in the case of cervix cancer, or pain and ulcerating masses in the case of head and neck cancer.
All this ties in with the research article Mayling has published in this special issue of Clinical Oncology, and we'll hear more about that a little later. But first, let's speak to Professor Yolande Leavens and hear about her latest research, which also appears in the special issue. She is the president of ESTRO and professor of radiation oncology at the University of Ghent in Belgium. She's also co-chair of the ESTRO Hero Project, which Danielle will tell us about in part two of the podcast. Professor Leavens was an integral part of the GTFRCC, and I started by asking how her research takes things forward from the GTFRC's findings published back in 2015.
This report of the Global Task Force focused on the availability and needs of radiotherapy and closing the gap in radiotherapy provision with the aim to close the gap by 2035. But it did not really in detail evaluate the actual availability and needs of radiotherapy, nor the cost at this point in time. So if we would close the gap by now, how much would it be? So we really wanted to look somewhat more in detail into the data that we have been producing for the Global Task Force, but not really focusing on the actual status of radiotherapy. Moreover, there are not that many data around in the world in terms of radiotherapy costs. And actually, the Global Task Force on Radiotherapy for Cancer Control was the first report that really produced data around the globe. But it focused on the cost by fraction and in terms of providing data for an investment framework. And there too, we really wanted to dig somewhat deeper into these data and look what would be the costs in terms of investment costs, in terms of operational costs, but then also the cost by fraction, the cost by course in the different regions of the world. And that's the last thing that I should highlight. Mostly, reports have been looking at different countries in a specific gross national income by capita levels. And this report really wanted to have a look at specific geographical regions of the world, because we do know that geographical regions may be very variable in terms of GNI per capita, so we wanted to focus on that aspect as well.
So you explained what you were looking at in this research, but what kind of methods and resources did you apply to obtain the data?
For this actual analysis, we first looked at the different geographical regions across the world, and we looked at which countries are incorporated in the different regions of the world, and for that we used the data from the IEA Technical Cooperation Department. Then we looked at the different GNI per capita of the countries, and we defined each country by upper and lower boundary in terms of GNI per capita. And then finally, we actually used two different models to derive our data. The first one, we wanted to know how many radiotherapy causes we would need to treat across the globe at this point in time. And to do so, we used the data of the evidence-based estimation method, the EBEST method from the Collaboration of Cancer Outcomes Research and Evaluation, the CCOR group in Australia. What they did, they defined actually a very detailed decision analytic model in which they incorporated all tumor types, and then they estimated how much radiotherapy within each tumor type would be needed. And that we applied to each country across the globe. So that defined the number of causes to be treated. The other model that we used was a time-driven activity-based costing model, which was also developed for the Global Task Force, but which was actually based on two former exercises from the IEA. It was one activity-based costing model that was defined indeed for calculating the costs, but the other one was more specifically targeted to estimate the resources in terms of human resources for a certain amount of patients to be treated. So we actually used these two models in order to come up with the number of courses to be delivered, the resources that we would need to cover these courses, and what it would cost in terms of operational cost, investment cost, cost per fraction, cost per cost.
And what were your main findings?
Well, the main findings were that indeed, as we had assumed before we started in looking it, into it in more detail, that there are very large variations in the GNI per capita for the different countries within each so-called geographical region, so that a geographical region by no means is something homogeneous, that you really have to look in more detail country by country. And then we have also found, and that was also already a finding from the Global Task Force, but we endorsed this, was that the wealth of a country clearly translates in the variability in available resources for radiotherapy, and that this again, of course, gives you an estimate of the resources that you'd need to invest in to make radiotherapy optimally accessible to all radiotherapy patients. So if we look at the currently available resources and related costs, then you can very easily say that the coverage in Africa is only about one-third of the optimal, whereas the coverage reaches about two-thirds in Asia-Pacific and in Europe and in Latin America, it hovers around 90%. Conversely, based on our computations, North America seems to have resources that are higher than what is really needed. Then the other part of the analysis that we've been doing was looking at the number of courses that we would need to generate full access. Then we looked at the correlated investments needed to optimize the access, investment in equipment, investing in departments. And for that, it's clear that there are two regions in the world that really have enormous challenges. The absolute challenges are the biggest in Asia Pacific. Their additional needs are only about 40-70%, but it's an enormous, highly densely populated continent, so the absolute needs are really very big. On the other side of the spectrum, you have Africa, and Africa really has additional needs that are in the order of magnitude of about 200% on top of what they already have, because there are so many countries in Africa that do not have any access to date to radiotherapy. And then you would think that both America, North America and Europe have no additional needs. Well, they do have. Although they are very well established in terms of radiotherapy, we still see that, especially in terms of human resources, there are still some gaps, and this is especially the case for radiation physicists.
Given that there are shortcomings in the provision of radiotherapy in Europe, does that make it even more challenging to expand access to radiotherapy across the world?
I think if you look at lower middle income countries, we typically think about investing in equipment and services, but I think we should be very much aware of the fact that radiotherapy is actually a very human resource demanding specialty. This is very often overlooked. So even if I already stressed that even in Europe we still need additional human resources to be trained, this is certainly a major challenge in low and middle income countries, because it's not enough to establish and invest in capacity in terms of departments or machines. You really need a dedicated personnel to keep this sustainable. And I think if you look at a region like Africa, where there's many countries, they do not have any radiotherapy availability whatsoever at this point. This is really an enormous challenge, because how can you train people if there's nothing in the country as yet? It is somewhat less of a problem in Asia Pacific, where there's already quite a large basis for radiotherapy in many countries. So you can start from there, use the available centers to train the personnel and to expand and cover the country slowly with radiotherapy resources. But as you mentioned, to my perspective, it's really not only being able to invest and find money for the equipment. There's much more to it, and human resources are an enormous important aspect of that.
Mei-Ling's research is the first study to quantify the potential benefits from radiotherapy if demand were met in each low and middle income country in the world as compared with zero usage of the treatment. So how is this study performed, and what are its findings?
So it's used the best available evidence in the sense of national and international guidelines, systematic review and meta-analysis to review all the up-to-date literature to make an estimate on the proportion of patients who would derive a local control and or survival benefit from radiotherapy as a result of radiotherapy being available in those countries. So the numbers I'm going to give you are not just for patients who would get radiotherapy. but really all cancer patients from that country, if we were to provide a radiotherapy service, and knowing that not everyone's going to get radiation because not every cancer patient needs radiation. So in terms of low and middle income country patients, in 2012, the year that we made the estimations, would be about 351,000 patients who would live longer solely because of radiotherapy. And then by 2035, we estimate that will rise to approximately 615,000 cases across all low and middle income countries.
And these benefits not only translate into economic benefit, like we discussed earlier, there are also some very significant societal benefits.
Particularly in many of these countries, the role of the mother is very important in the family unit, and without that, potentially children can be open to many issues such as homelessness and child prostitution, trafficking, all these kinds of issues. So to be able to keep young women, and they tend to be patients who are diagnosed with cervix cancer in these countries, tend to be mothers and often young mothers, to be able to keep them with their families is also a very important societal benefit that radiotherapy can make. As radiotherapy really is the main curative treatment for cervix cancer in these countries, where they often present with more advanced cervix cancers that can't necessarily be treated by surgery.
Now back to Dr. Moramel and the story of how the National Cancer Centre in Cambodia has been developed. It should be opening in April of this year and will house 3 radiotherapy machines alongside a full array of diagnostic services and surgical and medical oncology departments. Mora became involved with the project after he met with the inspirational Professor Soka, who has been a driving force behind the initiative. Professor Soka and the team behind the National Cancer Centre had to ensure the finances as well as international collaborations were in place to first fund building the cancer centre and second ensure doctors and other health professionals could be trained outside of Cambodia so that there would be enough adequately trained personnel available for when the unit opened.
There are 3 of us right now being trained in the Philippines, and we have 1 physician who were sent to Malaysia, and then we have some medical oncologists and oncohematologists who were sent to France, to Belgium, and the other countries as well.
Investment from the Cambodian government has been vital to this initiative. Organizations such as the IAEA, as well as supportive oncology departments around the world, have also proved critical to the program's success. But there are a number of challenges.
So one of the main challenges going to be how we can come and work together, because we went to different schools, we went to different training, even though there are some commonality in the training, but they still take some time in order to work together and make sure that we can develop our own guideline, which is applicable in our own setting. And of course, we are still in a low middle income country. So we don't really have the insurance like in the other developed countries yet. So most of the patients come to the hospital and they pay out of their own pocket. And cancer care is very expensive. So the challenge is how we can treat the patient, especially the poor one, and then still can maintain all the facilities used for cancer care as well.
In part 2, we'll hear more from Mora about what we can learn from what's been happening in Cambodia in order to translate this success into improved healthcare facilities across the globe. We'll also hear much more about what we can do to help facilitate and drive these changes forward. This will include an interview with Professor Jesper Grau Eriksson, who will tell us about innovative ways we can educate colleagues in low and middle income countries to help bridge this massive technology gap. Part 2 will be out in a couple of weeks' time, but in the meantime, check out the excellent research articles in the latest Clinical Oncology Special issue. Also have a look at the website, globalrt.org. There is a very powerful video on that site, which tells the story of a Peruvian woman with cancer, illustrating the human side to this story. For now, thanks for listening, and if you have any comments, email us at Clinical Oncology, and my Twitter handle is @safearmed_UK.